KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Joe Hill Centennial Tribute, Thursday, November 19th at 7 p.m. at the Alberta Rose Theater in Portland. Joe Hill was a member of the International Workers of the World and wrote the classic labor songs There's Power in a Union, The Rebel Girl, and many more. Joe Hill was executed by the state of Utah 100 years ago and will be remembered with a concert featuring Ann Feeney, Citizens Band, and General Strike. Again, that's the Joe Hill Centennial Tribute, Thursday, November 19th at 7 p.m. at the Alberta Rose Theater, 3000 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Today's guest is Stephen Zunis, who's a professor of politics, Middle Eastern studies at the University of San Francisco. And he will be with us to parse a recent piece that he had in The Progressive, Obama's escalation in Syria, as many listeners know, on at least 16 occasions, probably more, Obama reassured everyone, the American people and the world, that despite increased U.S. military involvement in Syria, there would be, get this, wait for it, no boots on the ground. Well, now, there's no Syria to put boots on. It's pretty much the failed state poster child for history's his record at this point, as we are indeed writing history with every blink of the eye and every click of the key. So, that said, I want to, before we speak with Stephen Zunis on this article, Obama's Escalation in Syria, it came out in The Progressive, and if I am able to get this up on the KBOO website, you will find links to this stunning article. Zunis has done in this piece is no less than take everything that has built up to this moment, and he is, of course, a historian, and laid it out on the table. When you do lay it out on the table, what it looks like is not what it looks like from a distance is not what it looks like close up. In other words, in the sound bites that pass for news these days, it's a quite different picture. And it is far more alarming than it was originally sold to us. And that was often the case, but Syria is a very extreme case of this. It is an extreme case of what we call a failed state. This makes some many other pathways. Look at a map. Routes getting fossil, and thence where they, but not for that, then we would have a very, very different view of the Keystone XL. It's only one tiny piece in a much bigger puzzle, and that is that puzzle that we have yet to confront. Now, that said, a Canadian Pacific Railway train derailed yesterday. It spilled. It's funny how the mainstream media writes. It spilled. The mainstream media. It spilled less than 1,000 gallons, and the other side says it spilled nearly 1,000 gallons. My guess is it's probably way more than 1,000 gallons of crude oil. And they had to evacuate to various places in Wisconsin. Second day in a row, a freight train derailed in that state. That was yesterday. The incident comes after a freight train derailed near Alma in western Wisconsin. That one spilled thousands of gallons of ethanol. That might be a worse cleanup too than the other. Portland police say officers shot and killed a suicidal man who pointed a gun at his head. A lot more to say about that, but you can probably guess what it is anyway. President Obama's announcement that he would send, of course, this is what we're going to talk about, and the Bonneville Power Administration is expected to release its final environmental impact statement. It's got big plans, does the BPA, for a new power line between Washington and Oregon by the years. And this is something that is not talked about much. We've talked about it a great deal, you know, from time to time, but now, again, it's raised its ugly head, and it definitely bears very close scrutiny. Now, turning to Missouri, amid the wave of student and faculty protests, hunger strike, where the chap who is carrying out the hunger strike, and this will be a week now, has signed a do not resuscitate directive. And at this point, Timothy Wolf, president of the university and businessman, has finally stepped down amid demands that he do so last week. And as the world knows now, President Barack Obama, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu get together today for the first time in, since Netanyahu lost his war against Iran's nuclear deal. And we talked a lot about that with Stephen. That said, of course, what Netanyahu's really here for is the money. He wants more money for more weapons with which to pretty much finish up the genocide that he's carrying out against the Palestinian people. And on that note, we turn to our guest today, Stephen Zunis. Thanks for your patience, Stephen. What an incredible piece you have here. I do believe that it's okay to have boots on the ground when there's no more Syria, and it seems that Syria has pretty much disintegrated into warring states. I wanted to ask you about, Obama says he's going to send 50 special forces to train, advise, and assist. What is he really saying here?
Well, this is definitely an escalation. Despite repeated pledges of no boots on the ground, it appears there will indeed be boots on the ground, albeit a fairly small number in a fairly localized place geographically and in a fairly prescribed role. But many people are concerned that this is kind of a foot in the door, that we have had a gradual escalation of U.S. Involvement in that conflict. Over the past several months and years. And this is all being done without authorization of Congress, despite the constitutional prerogative of Congress to declare war, not to mention the War Powers Resolution of 1973, which prohibits the president from sending American forces into hostile situations for more than 90 days unless and until they get explicit authorization from Congress to do so. And President Obama does not have such approval. So there are a number of dangers about this escalating U.S. role, but one of the most dangerous is the threat it has to the U.S. Constitution.
Well, yes, there is that, but that's never stopped Obama and other and his predecessors. What I want to ask you about, it's of course, doesn't come as much of a surprise that we have Netanyahu imploring Obama to provide more money for more weapons into a region that's already flooded with weaponry. The U.S.'s economy is flat on its backside, and I suppose manufacture of these things, the weapons used in small-scale warfare, they're keeping it afloat. It seems to me, too, that I want to ask you about so you've got a region that is flooded with weapons, and this region that is accustomed to internecine tribal wars, which have been going on forever, but this really does raise the stakes. How it going forward?
Well, first of all, I want to challenge a stereotype about internecine tribal wars. I mean, this may have been the case in some of the mountains of Yemen and a few other remote areas, but in general, the kind of violence that we have seen in places in Syria and in Iraq are fairly new phenomenon, and they have been a direct result of foreign, including U.S. Intervention that has stoked long-dormant sectarian tensions. I mean, fighting between Shiites and Sunnis, you know, was kind of a historic thing, the way we looked at the wars between Catholics and Protestants in Europe, you know, several centuries ago. And occasionally it would spread, it would flare up in a place like Northern Ireland when the sectarian divisions would parallel nationalist divisions. But by and large, it was not that big a deal. I mean, theologically, there's less differences between Sunnis and Shias than there are between Catholics and Protestants. But it's been, when you overthrow a secular government in Iraq, and you know there are secular governments being challenged in Syria, these things will tend to come to the forefront. And the tragedy in Syria was that the initial uprising against Assad back in 2001 was a grassroots, indigenous, democratic, nonviolent, and multi-ethnic, multi-religious movement. But a combination of the relative weakness of civil society in that country, the sinister divide and rule tactics of the government, and the severe repression led some people to take up arms. But then immediately you had a number of foreign countries, including those in Saudi Arabia and Qatar, started arming some of these Islamist groups, and then ISIS emerged, which is a mostly Iraqi-led group that is a direct outgrowth of the U.S. Invasion. Most of the ISIS leaders were former prisoners of the United States in Iraq, and along with the former commanders in Saddam's army that we suddenly made unemployed when we took over and radicalized them in the course of the occupation. And it's ended up being the incredible tragedy where you have this brutally repressive government under Assad's leadership in Damascus, combined with the extremist groups like ISIS and other hardcore Islamists as well. The so-called moderate rebels, some of them, I guess you could say, are moderate, but they are factionalized into literally hundreds of different armed units. I mean, the U.S. put in $500,000 to arm and train some so-called moderate levels, and only a few dozen were deployed, and they were quickly overrun by forces of the al-Nusra Front, which was a al-Qaeda-affiliated organization, which then took all the weapons. In fact, most of the weapons that belonged to ISIS are of American origin. U.S. has not been arming ISIS directly, obviously, but you know the weapons they've captured from the Iraqi armed forces and from other groups that were shipped from Saudi Arabia are U.S. origin. So, you know, what you're mentioning about how the U.S. weapons are fanning the flames, not just the ones we send directly to people we support, but the ones we send to groups that we ones that are seized by forces we oppose.
So, in the last minute that we have here, with these 50 so-called U.S. special forces, who they're training, advising, and assisting, what, if any, effect could that part? Could that? How it's difficult for me to imagine what effect that might have.
Apparently, what the plan is that these 50 special forces, Green Berets, will support some armed Arab Sunni groups, which the U.S. recognizes are to be the most effective to defy ISIS, which gets most of their support from the Arab Sunni community, and work with the Kurdish fighters, which are by far the most effective fighters so far against ISIS. I mean, one reason ISIS has been able to take over large swaths of northern Syria and Iraq is that the troops of the government they're fighting aren't very motivated, because the governments in Baghdad and Damascus are corrupt and not very popular. So the idea is, let's get this force of people who do have of popular support. They might have a better chance of making a difference. So, you know, there is some strategic logic to it, I guess. But, you know, frankly, I'm a little skeptical because Syria is such a mess, so factionalized, so divided. There's so many unknowns. And frankly, the more the United States has militarized the region, the more we've gotten involved. it tends to make things worse and worse and worse.
That's maybe what we've seen in the past. Stephen, we're out of time. Yeah, thank you so much for joining us today. It has, as always, been a pleasure to speak with you. We've been speaking, of course, with Stephen Tunis. He's a professor of politics in the Middle East, with emphasis in the Middle East in the University of San Francisco. This has been Air Cascadia for Monday, November 9th in 2015. Kate Wilton engineered the show for us today. Thanks for that, Kate. Captain Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
President Obama visits a federal prison. There's a call to federal prosecutors to